So without any further ado, I'll introduce our first two speakers from APRA. Katrina Ellis is a senior manager at APRA. She joined APRA as the head of research in 2008 after a career as an academic. From 2011, she's been the business lead for APRA's project implementing the Stronger Super reforms. This has involved leading the policy team who developed the superannuation prudential standards and accompanying prudential practice guides, revised the superannuation data collection, and developed the MySuper authorisation process. So, Katrina, would you join us up on stage to start with? And while you're coming up, I'll introduce Rodney. Rodney's an actuarial advisor at APRA. Rodney's worked in the superannuation industry for over 20 years and has been a part of the actuarial services team within APRA for over 5 years, specialising in the field of superannuation. So if you can join us up on stage as well, Rodney.
Thank you, and I think I'm the only non-actuary in the room, so that's a little bit daunting to be speaking to this audience. But and I think also the way that Andrew introduced things, yes, I've been leading the team at APRA that has developed all of the APRA framework for the reforms, so hopefully you don't consider that it's all my fault, but to some degree it has been the work of my team. So Rod and I are going to tag team up here. I'll start off, then Rod will talk in the middle, and then I'll finish off. I think it is fair to say that it has been an extraordinary couple of years with the amount of changes sort of flowing out to the industry with an enormous number of consultation packages for people to digest and comment on and try and participate in shaping the reforms. It's been a time where there's been probably more collaboration between Treasury, APRA, ASIC and the ATO than we've typically seen in the past. We've really had to work together to piece together our various elements of the reforms. And I think it's also been a time where, going back a couple of years, with the industry bodies in the superannuation industries, they've actually started working together a lot more as well. So it's really been a big effort of collaboration that I think there was probably a realisation that without the collaboration we probably had no chance of getting these getting to understand these reforms together. And also during this time at APRA, we had a change at the head. So Ross Jones, our deputy chair, retired. But I think we're all extremely happy that Helen Rowell is the new member for superannuation. And she has certainly been part of the reforms from the beginning. She's been the business owner at APRA, and so now she is continuing that role as our top superannuation person. Even though we've seen that change, I think we're pretty confident that it's smooth sailing for APRA. So I guess the overall messages that we'll end up with after Rod and I speak this morning is there is generally reform fatigue. There's an overwhelming quantity of changes for people to get their heads around. And we're not really there yet. The implementation is really going to take another couple of years from now. So it's time, I guess, to sort of do a bit of a stock take, see where we are. And I think it's actually going to be really interesting this morning to have another couple of speakers who aren't talking about these reforms but talking about the future. Our head is very definitely in these reforms, but there were certainly some areas post-retirement that really haven't been touched at all, so there's still, I guess, some reform down the line. So APRA's part in the Stronger Super reforms was to do the implementation of a large amount of the Cooper recommendations that the government supported. So the MySuper authorisation process, creating prudential standards and supporting those prudential standards with prudential practice guides, the reporting standards, so creating a new data collection for superannuation to match the prudential standards and to upgrade data collection that hadn't been touched since 2004. And then also APRA's got a role to play in Superstream. And so we'll run through all of these this morning. I guess I'll just touch on Superstream now because don't have a separate slide on Superstream. The ATO has really been carrying Superstream, but APRA has a role in, so we administer the part of the law that applies to the APRA-regulated funds, so we need to have oversight of the compliance with the Superstream standards. And as we're now going through the process of everybody actually moving towards implementing Superstream, APRA is very much involved in talking with the super funds about this. I think, so for those of you, I'm hoping most people are familiar with Superstream. Broadly, I would describe it as an industry-wide simultaneous IT build, which, when you say it like that, it's a pretty heroic attempt to move the entire industry into e-commerce. So it's just kicked off now. The ATO has had one round of, guinea pigs go through their transition to doing electronic rollovers. And that process is going to continue over the next 6 months. And hopefully we get the whole industry through in 6 months, but I think there will be some hiccups along the way. Most importantly, I think there's broad acknowledgement that the end point of where we're trying to get to with Superstream is a vast improvement about from where historically we've been. It's just going to be a very difficult implementation process for everybody to actually build the IT systems that allows them to communicate with the rest of the industry in a standardised way. So first to my super. So when I handed in these slides last week, we had 57 MySuper RSE licensees authorised to offer a MySuper product. We now have 62 up on our website, so it's very much a work in progress for us. The process is going very smoothly from our perspective. There has been really, I think this is a very good example of the close interaction between the entities and the supervisors. Right from the beginning, we were focusing on talk to your supervisor early, get a draft application in, and that has really been key to this process working smoothly. And even now, even though we've authorised more than 60, they're all different. We're still finding that, there's new things in each of the draft applications that come in, so it's not as if we've sort of seen everything and any application at this stage is just the same as one we've seen before. There's still new issues coming up with each application, and so those drafts and the early conversations have been really important. I think what we've found is, probably we were surprised that the uptake of lifecycle products has been greater than we would have originally anticipated. So that's going forward in the ongoing supervision. That's going to be a new challenge for APRA to see how those products actually work and how trustees manage those. And this has been the application process is really APRA's first glimpse at compliance with the prudential standards. The way that the application process has worked is we look at the applications and consider does the material in the package indicate that you're likely to comply with the prudential standards on an ongoing basis rather than already full compliance. And so what's been happening with these applications is, yes, we think you're likely to comply, but there's actually, a short list of items that supervisors are noting down to follow up. It was good enough to get through the application, but we just want to make sure that on an ongoing basis, a few extra things are actually bedded down and working smoothly. And when I think back 2 years ago, we were thinking there were going to be about 1,000 MySuper products. That was sort of the numbers that were floating around. I think there was some people were saying 5,000. So it's been a real learning game to see how the industry has thought through these products. We think we're about halfway with the number of products we've got right now. And the big surprise is that really we aren't seeing we aren't expecting very many individual tailored large employer MySuper products. So even though the legislation was set up to allow for those, and initially we thought there might be about 1,000 of those ones, just given the number of sort of large employer subplans in Master Trusts, it doesn't look like that's going to be the case. And I think as the legislation evolved and people saw that as we got more clarity on how insurance would work in MySuper, there was actually more flexibility within a single MySuper that meant you didn't need to have a separate MySuper for a large employer. So we're going along smoothly with the MySuper authorisations. I think the big space we're going to be watching over the next couple of years around MySuper is how those prior default balances get transitioned across to MySuper. So a lot of the work has been done to identify where those default balances are, but we still need to see those move across into MySuper. Then with the prudential standards, APRA has been wanting to get prudential standards making power in super ever since APRA was founded, because we want to have a consistent approach, a consistent framework across all of the industries that we regulate. So this was really something that APRA had been waiting for a long time. We finalised the standards in November 2012, except for three that we had to wait for the final pieces of legislation to come through just before 1 July 2013, but those came through, so all of the prudential standards were in place by 1 July 2013. And really, now that we've seen the MySuper applications, the focus for all of our supervisors is very much turning to how are we going to supervise in this world with prudential standards on an ongoing basis. So for supervisors of the financial conglomerates, they're very familiar with this space through the banking and the insurance arms that they've been supervising. But for some of our supervisors who focus solely on superannuation, the prudential standards are a new framework for them, as well as new for the entities. So there is a bit of learning internally as well as learning in the industry. Because the number of MySuper applications were actually lower than we expected, so there are some entities out there that we haven't really had any visibility yet about their approach to the prudential standards, because they didn't put in a MySuper application. So that is sort of the first step, is to make sure that we actually have coverage across and visibility across how trustees are approaching the prudential standards. There are a lot of new policies and frameworks and procedures that need to be documented through the prudential standards. And I think our first step, although we really have written up here, we don't want tick box compliance, we do need to sort of go through a baseline and just make sure that there aren't any compliance gaps. But the prudential standards are principles based, and we really want each trustee to tailor them to their own circumstances. And I think because of the large workload, there has just been a bit of let's get something in place and just make sure we hit the mark with the prudential standards, but it's not really yet living and breathing the world of prudential standards. So we are emphasising to the trustees that Section 52 has changed, and we have the new Section 52A. So there are enhanced trustee duties. There's enhanced trustee duties around MySuper. So these are important. I guess conflicts management is one of the key areas that it's not so much business as usual. We really want to focus on making sure potential conflicts and actual conflicts are identified and then managed or avoided if they can't be managed. So there really is a lot of work to do here to bed these down and to make sure that people are actually living and breathing the prudential standards rather than just copying and pasting words from our prudential standard and say we've taken all of these factors into consideration. It needs to be more than that, but at this starting point I think we are seeing a little bit of that pure compliance. The supporting the prudential standards are our prudential practice guides, and these I guess over the last 2 years there was frustration from the industry when we first put out our draft prudential standards, and then it was, well, where's the interpretation material? And it took us some time to get that out. We still haven't quite finalised it. But to the extent that we could answer industry's questions as they were coming up, we were using FAQs a lot during this whole process, and we've now incorporated those into the PPGs. The big change for super, because we've had a lot of guidance material out over the last 10 years for super, but the big change is really reflecting APRA's approach that with prudential standards, and now that we've had APRA we've had licensing for APRA regulated funds since 2006. So really we're now in a world where we expect trustees to be professional and to not really need perhaps the hand holding from APRA that they've had in the past. And so we have had quite a few questions about where has some of the material that used to be guidance, where has it gone? It hasn't been incorporated into the PPGs. And this has actually been deliberate from APRA's perspective to scale back the detail, because we don't want to tell trustees how to run their business. We want to step back, put the principles out as the requirements in the standards, and give some guidance broadly, but leave it up to each trustee to make the standards work for them. And so we've aligned, I guess, the level of our guidance with the type of guidance that we have in insurance and banking. But that is a big change for the superannuation industry. And before my final slide before I hand over to Rod, the other arm to our work has been the reporting standards, and I think this is probably the big remaining piece of work for everybody, and it's giving the industry considerable headaches from as far as I can tell from the feedback that we're getting, because everybody is now coming to terms with the details of the reporting standards. So we did completely overhaul the data collection. It was well overdue that we needed to do that, but it has meant that at this time when everything else is changing, we're also changing the data collection. So we do appreciate that this is just adding to the amount of work at the moment. We've had some concerns about timeframes of when things are due, and we're just going to stick with our standard process of with our statistics area, that anybody who needs more time or feels that they can't actually report the data as it's required on the due date, to contact our statistics area, and then we'll work with them on a case-by-case basis. We don't actually think that there is a need to do an industry-wide extension at this stage. So the first quarterly reports, there's about six forms in that first quarter. The big area where there's a lot of work to be done is on investments. So APRA has gone into greater detail in investments than we've ever gone before. We're looking through investment vehicle structures, And this is the area that people are really scratching their heads about how they're going to do this. We've been engaging with various service providers in the investment space. So we've been talking regularly with the Custodians Association and with other service providers, as well as talking with individual entities about their situation and how their systems hold the investments data and what they feel they can and cannot report to APRA. So I think that everybody is well aware that this first year of data, these first four quarters we're going to get, is going to be probably quite ugly data, and it will take some time until we iron out some of the hiccups in the data. But you know, it is just a transition, and we're more than willing to work with entities over this time period. But it's definitely on the investment side. This is an area that internally where we really need a greater level of detail of data, and we're really looking forward to getting that data, but we do realise that it's a big change. Unfortunately, I've got quite a long list of things here that of things that still haven't quite been bedded down in the data collection space, and so appreciate that that's very frustrating to the industry when you're trying to implement these changes and you don't have the final requirements yet. We did a consultation in July about three forms related to disclosure, and I'll talk about those after Rod's spoken. And because at the moment with the election we're in the caretaker period and can't actually release any final versions of things, so we'll be looking to release the final versions of those after the election. The remainder, so the choice product dashboard and choice investment performance information, we'll be looking to, we'll be waiting to see where the, whichever government it is, where they end up on choice disclosure, and then we will be mirroring that in our reporting standards. We have consulted on some benchmarking measures for Superstream, and we are working now with the industry bodies to finalise those before we release those. The key thing is Superstream was all about reducing administrative costs, and so we want to try and measure that, but what we found when we consulted is it's going to be very difficult to measure that. So we're working with the industry bodies to try and figure out what might be an appropriate way to measure that. APRA collects data for the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and they're going to be consulting on what their new reporting requirements are going to be. And also APRA will be consulting on what we're going to publish out of the data that we collect. And this will be a really important consultation because one of the key decisions is which data items are confidential and which data items are non-confidential and then hence out in the public domain. And so we have to balance financial stability with competition and other elements. And so, yes, we want to get a lot of data out in the public domain, but we also want to make sure that we're not compromising any financial stability or compromising any sort of commercial confidentiality by doing that. So that'll be an opportunity for everybody to provide feedback to APRA about the data elements. So now I'll hand over to Rod to go through some specifics of the Prudential Standards.
Thanks, Katrina. Unlike Katrina, I actually wasn't a direct member of the Super Reform team at APRA. However, I was part of a wider group within APRA who assisted the reform team and myself as an actuary. Particularly, I was involved in the reforms relating to defined benefit funds. As Katrina, these reforms did actually cover a broad range of areas within superannuation. However, the key areas I will be discussing today, I guess, are the ones which directly impact on actuaries and, I guess, the roles they carry out in superannuation. So as on the screen we have there, we've got the Prudential Standard 160, SPS 160, the defined benefit matters, the reporting standards relating to defined benefits and to self-insurance, and also, I guess, the fit and proper requirements for an RSC actuary. Okay, so I guess the main area of the reforms, I guess, which I believe which impact on actuaries and what they're involved in is... the main areas, I guess, of the reforms which, I guess, involve what the actuary does in superannuation is covered under Prudential Standard SPS 160. I guess as a part of this process in developing the standard and the associated guidance, we actually went out to industry, including the Actuaries Institute, to consult with them on the changes and what we were proposing. And the feedback that we got from this process was incorporated within the standard and the guides as they were being finalised. Now, I guess the standard itself basically covers, I guess, a wide range of requirements, but I guess I'd put them into two areas. There are areas which, I guess, are already existing requirements and they have simply been transferred across into this standard. And there are other, I guess, newer requirements which mostly, I believe, would cover existing practice. So, in effect, while the standard does impose some new requirements on trustees, I guess we feel that the aim of these is to actually codify existing practice rather than to change it. I guess some of the more straightforward features of the standard, include clarifying the requirements with respect to funds and sub-funds. I guess, as we know in the past, there's always been an issue as to do we apply things to the fund as a whole or to sub-funds, and there's always this going back and forth between us and the trustees as to what to do it. Under this standard, we're basically clarifying it so that these requirements can apply to either the fund as a whole or to each of the individual sub-funds, and that's up to the trustee, I guess, to decide what approach they wish to take. This standard also sets out the requirements for the timing of initial and regular investigations. These requirements basically have remained unchanged and have simply just been transferred across from the CIS regs. The one part which has changed in terms of these valuations, I guess, is the timing of the provision of the reports. In the old legislation, they used to do a one-year time frame to produce the reports. With the new the standard, we have reduced this down to 6 months. However, I guess there is a three-year transitional period, starting from the 1 July 2013, whereby a nine-month period is going to be allowed. I guess the area which is a bit more straightforward is the self-insurance arrangements. While these are new requirements within, I guess, the legislation, I guess we believe that these requirements basically cover what existing practice is, and hence they don't actually really impose anything new on what actuaries do with these funds. I guess, in fact, the Actuaries Institute itself has, for a number of years now, produced guidance to actuaries on the financial management of self-insurance arrangements, and we feel that this will continue in the same approach. However, I guess some of the more significant changes introduced by the standard, I guess, include the introduction of a shortfall limit, the requirements relating to interim investigations, and the formalisation of rectification plans when a fund has breached the shortfall limit. That being said, we do believe that the formalisation of rectification plans is another example of simply codifying existing practice. While the standard does provide a more detailed and structured approach for dealing with funds which have become unsatisfactory, we believe that this approach simply reflects what current practice is and does not actually impose anything really new on actuaries and non-trustees. For us, the advantage of these changes is that it does provide APRA itself with greater powers to deal with funds which have become unsatisfactory, where in the past is always a case of us having to go out and to encourage trustees to put in place plans and to work together with them in that respect. Now, I guess we have the powers there to say this is what needs to be done, and provides a bit more of a structure. And we believe that also would help trustees as well in providing them with much more of a formalised arrangement as to what to do. However, I guess as a part of this process, I guess APRA was conscious of the fact that we didn't want to actually impose onerous requirements on trustees if a fund's best of benefit index, you know, temporarily fell below 100% simply due to market volatility. So to help counter for this, that's why we introduced the concept of the shortfall limit and interim investigations. So basically, outside of the regular investigation cycle, A trustee is only actually required to conduct an interim investigation if it appears that the fund is or may be in breach of the shortfall limit. Then if that interim investigation itself finds that the fund is in breach of the shortfall limit, that is when a rectification plan would then need to be implemented. So the intent of this requirement is just to avoid the additional and perhaps unnecessary remedial action due to short-term market fluctuations. So I guess the question is, what do we expect a shortfall limit to be? Well, how do we expect a shortfall limit to be set, and what factors do we believe should be taken into consideration? Well, from our perspective, there are two aspects to this approach. One is, looking at the reasons why the fund has reduced to be below 100%, and the second relates to what factors can impact the fund returning to a satisfactory position once that limit has been breached. I guess now with respect to the first aspect, as to why the fund has reduced to be below 100%, from APRA's point of view, the market volatility is the only reason or the only factor that can be taken into account when considering this. For example, if a fund became unsatisfactory simply due to the fact that the employer didn't contribute to the fund at the rates it was supposed to contribute, or they were paying out larger retrenchment benefits due to some kind of retrenchment program, APRA would expect these issues, I guess, to be addressed immediately and not just when it breached the shortfall limit. And the other aspect, we also don't want employers to think they can actually target a lower VBI simply because it's actually just above that shortfall limit. So if the shortfall limit was 95%, we wouldn't want trustees to go out there thinking they could target a 97% level simply because of that the shortfall limit is lower. However, I guess how these factors impact on the fund returning to a satisfactory position, or how they or the likelihood of them doing so, they can be taken into account in that respect. For example, if the trustee was concerned that the employer may have trouble putting extra money in, or they may have issues with them putting in extra money to a fund, they can actually have a tighter shortfall limit just to counteract for those in those kind of circumstances. So the factors. So while we say market volatility is the only reason you can take into account when looking at why it drops below, it can look at a broader spectrum of factors in working at what the shortfall limit is in the particular circumstances of that fund. I guess in addition, the only other requirement for the shortfall limit is that it can't be set below the technical insolvency requirement level. So if the fund has a VBI which is quite close to what the minimum benefits of the fund is, then obviously the shortfall limit's going to have to be very close to 100%. So that's, I guess, the only lower condition that we have imposed. After that, it's up to the funds and the trustees and the actuaries themselves to work out what that limit should be, as long as it's reasonable. I guess one other thing to further note in terms of SPS 160 is that there are a couple of legislative requirements which remain unchanged, even though they are not included within this standard. The first relates to the reporting obligations under Section 130 of the SIS Act, which relate to when a fund drops below 100% or into an unsatisfactory financial position. In those cases, even if the fund hasn't breached its shortfall limit, if the actuary does form the opinion that the financial position may or may be about to become unsatisfactory, there is still that obligation to report to APRA in that case. So as soon as the fund drops below 100, APRA still is expected to find out or to be advised of that, even if the shortfall limit hasn't yet been breached. Secondly, the technical insolvency provisions still apply, so there's effectively going to be two levels of, of supervision in this respect. You've got your VBI level and your shortfall limit attached to that, but there is the technical insolvency requirements still apply. So if the fund does go technically insolvent, those provisions under the SIS reg still do apply, and those procedures would still have to be taken, underwent. So what has been our experience so far? Well, given that these requirements only came into effect on 1 July this year, I guess there's been no real test to date. Our impression on the implementation of the shortfall limit, though, has been reasonable, and this has probably been helped by the fact that the Actuaries Institute itself has provided guidance to actuaries to assist in helping to set those shortfall limits and and I guess how to go about that process. So I guess the first broad test will be when there is a market downturn, and so we'll just have to wait and see what occurs at that time. While the standard for SPS 160 has been finalised, the associated guidance is still being finalised at the moment, and we expect this to be finalised and issued hopefully by November. Okay. As discussed by Katrina, APRA has also changed the data collection requirements. These include a number of forms which will directly relate to the defined benefit funds. In particular, SRF 160 outlines the annual data requirements, and SRF 160.1 outlines the quarterly requirements. Again, a trustee can either report these this data for the fund as a whole or individually for each sub-fund. Now, the aim of these reporting standards is to basically assist ourselves in monitoring the requirements of the new prudential standard. The main difference between the two standards, I guess while one is annual and one is quarterly, is that the SRF 160, which is the annual data requirements, the purpose of that one is just to get a feel for the financial position of the fund based on the results from the most recent actuarial investigations. So this can either be done from the most recent regular valuation, or it could be an interim valuation, whichever way gets to the most current data has been, and if there have been any update in those figures since the last regular valuation. As such, there may be a number of items on this form which actually won't change from year to year, because obviously not all trustees will carry out a valuation every year. So there will be items which will be the same from year to year and which we expect to remain the same. On the other hand, the SRF 160.1 is going to be reported quarterly, and the main aim of this one is basically to help APRA to get a feel for how things are changing during the year and help us to monitor if there are any short-term trends emerging in the data. I guess the important thing to note here under the quarterly requirements is that, yes, we do expect there to be a vested benefit value in that reporting and a vested benefit index, but these numbers are, we only intend to be estimates only, and while actuaries, I guess, are best suited to produce these numbers, we don't necessarily expect actuaries to have to produce these figures. So if the trustee feels confident in producing those figures themselves or getting other people to do it, then we are happy with that approach. Obviously, we don't want to put all these new onerous requirements or new onerous costs unnecessarily on trustees. And that's basically there, just to get a feel for what, you know, how things are changing during the year. The other, I guess, the reporting standards which have changed are in relation to self-insurance. I guess, as you're aware, APRA does not, we don't encourage funds to self-insure. We'd like the super funds to concentrate mainly on the provision of retirement benefits and to let the insurance be dealt with by the insurance companies. But obviously there are funds out there which do self-insure. But one thing that has changed from 1 July this year is that we no longer allow accumulation funds to self-insure. So the only funds which would have any form of self-insurance at this point are going to be defined benefit funds. But as such, with the new requirements and the new reporting, we've also tightened the requirements under the standard. But we've also, flowing on from that, we've actually expanded our data reporting to help us to be able to monitor the policies and just to ensure that trustees have proper policies and monitoring in place. Hence the need to provide more detailed information on, I guess, the actuarial recommendations associated with, I guess, the annual review of the arrangements, member coverage, premiums, claims and the reinsurance arrangements. Now, I guess, as Katrina mentioned earlier, with all this new data that we are collecting, what data will be published and what format it will be in is still to be finalised, and which we do expect to be done by the end of the year. I guess the final area, I guess, which we believe will have a direct impact on actuaries is the fit and proper requirements. Now, under professional standard SPS 520, which covers the fit and proper requirements, an ROC actuary is now considered to be a responsible person. Hence, the trustee has to satisfy itself that the actuary is a fit and proper person for the role. To do this, I guess AFRA have taken a principles-based approach, and we haven't necessarily mandated how the trustee should do this or what documents they should be provided or what they should be asking actuaries to provide. While we understand there are different trustees taking different approaches and also requiring different different information be provided, I guess APRA, and we have actually had feedback from industry in that respect, I guess APRA does believe that, you know, we want to take this, we don't want to set a mandated fixed approach. So obviously we want the trustees to decide what information they need and how they'd be provided. I guess one possibility is that the Actuaries Institute itself may, you know, provide some guidance in that respect if they feel that it's necessary to do so. I guess that's all I need to say for now, and I'll hand you back to Katrina.
So just to finish off, I want to quickly talk about risk management and then the product dashboard. So governance and risk management are really the two pillars that we focus on with supervision. And so the risk management framework, and in particular focusing on operational risk, these are two areas that we are really going to be focusing on over the next couple of years with ongoing supervision to make sure that these are bedded down and really become part of how a trustee does its business. Overall, we're trying to make sure that trustees create a solid risk culture within their organisations. Our principles-based approach, just as Rod was talking about it with regards to fit and proper, but here with the risk management, we really want to see trustees adapting the requirement to have a risk management framework to their particular setting. And so who does the risk functions? This can be quite different depending on if you're a small corporate fund or a part of a financial conglomerate. And we want to see that variety of approaches because it needs to be different in each of those situations. And it's about the trustees having clarity on how risk management is done, and it's about the management having clarity on who's got responsibility for what. The risk appetite statement is a key document, and so risk appetite statements are now being produced, but we really need to make sure that they're actually understood by the people who use them, and they're not just a pretty document that sits on the shelf. We really want these to describe what are the tolerances, what are the key risks, what are the tolerances for those risks, and make sure that that those are well communicated throughout the organisation. As far as operational risk, yes, we've introduced the operational risk financial requirement, but that really is just one part of it. The key thing is managing operational risks, so identifying operational risks, controlling those, monitoring those controls, and then reviewing the appropriateness of those and reviewing to make sure that all of the key operational risks are actually identified. So our focus is really going to be on the management of operational risk with the operational risk financial requirement as a supplement to that. And I think an important thing that we're going to be focusing on over the next couple of years is, with all of this change, with the systems changes that are in play, that are happening, and with all of the changes of operations as people are embedding these prudential standards, there's going to be heightened operational risk in this time. As the accrued default amounts move across into MySuper, there's just a wide variety of examples of potential heightened operational risk. And so we're going to be looking to that quite carefully. And there are a variety of elements in the reforms that are really going to shine the light on poor data quality. So data integrity is a key area where we'll be focusing over the next few years. So whether that's insurance data, whether it's data around just the membership demographics, or whether it's data around your investments, we are really aware of data integrity issues in the industry. So risk management is has always been a key focus, and really it's still front and centre for APRA. The final thing, as we wrap up, is the product dashboard. So this is one of the disclosure forms that APRA consulted on in July. So the Cooper report recommended that there be developed a product dashboard so that all MySuper products could be developed, could be compared. And the way that this has been implemented is quite a layered approach. So there's a requirement in the CIS Act to have a product dashboard that's supported by regulations which go into a bit more detail about what the product dashboard might look like, specifically that there'll be a graph of historical performance. But also because APRA is going to be collecting periodically all of the items reported on the product dashboard, it falls to the APRA reporting standards to then provide some more detail about defining those data items. So we have these sort of three tiers of law about what the content of the product dashboard is. By putting the details into the reporting standards, that will actually allow more flexibility for these to be updated in the future. We wouldn't want to have to go to a change in the CIS Act just to change a calculation methodology for one of the items in the dashboard. But we can, APRA can do that quite easily by updating our reporting standards. So the approach of putting the detail in a legislative instrument as opposed to in the Act or the regulations does provide the ability for these to be updated in the future in a timely fashion. Now, so we've consulted on what's going to be in our reporting standard, but APRA has to work within constraints of what's been set so far by the government on the product dashboard. And the government has made it very clear that in order to compare MySuper products, they want the information to be net of all costs. So net of investment costs and administration costs as well. So this then creates some technical issues that we've tried to address in our reporting standard, but I guess I want to emphasise we think we've got a starting point, and we think this is probably likely to develop over the next couple of years as people bed this down. So the net investment return would be from unit prices. So as far as sort of reporting on your product dashboard what your return target is or what your historical performance has been or what your statement of fees and costs are going to be, it's built up around a net return. So the net investment return is just net of investment fees and costs, but the net return is net of investment fees and costs, but also and taxes, but also net of administration, advice, fees, costs and taxes. And then we get into the difficulty of there's different charging bases for admin fees compared to investment fees. And so then how do we actually try and make this comparable? So these are some of the issues that we consulted with on industry. We've used a representative member approach where we take a member with a $50,000 balance and say we'll calculate what the admin fees would be for that member. And we're doing this not because we think the average member necessarily has $50,000 in each fund. We're not trying to provide a number that is the actual performance for any individual member. It's a comparative number. So across all of the MySuper products, if you look at the net return, you know that it's for the same type of member. It's someone with a $50,000 balance, and so any flat dollar fees are translated into percentages on a consistent basis. So we thought that $50,000 was a reasonable number to use because it's currently used in the PDS and it would be familiar to the industry, but it has certainly raised some debate, and I think we'll hear about that later this morning. Another area that's raised debate is how do you have a standardised measure of investment risk? And so across the industry there hasn't been a consistent way of reporting risk. ASFA and the FSC came up with number of negative years in 20, It's not a perfect measure. It doesn't say how big those negative returns are. But it's a starting point. It doesn't necessarily... It's a volatility measure. We're aware of that. And we're actually looking forward to the industry working together to improve this measure over time. But at this stage, it's the best we've got, and that's what's in the product dashboard. So the aim with the dashboard is really to have consistent calculations, comparable calculations. They're not trying to be the performance for any one member. And really, it's a starting point, and it's going to be something that we'll have to see how the first product dashboards look, and then over time, APRA fully expects some improvements to come. And so we look forward to your contributions to those improvements. So to just finish, it is a long road ahead. We've thrown an enormous amount of changes at the industry, both APRA's changes, but the other changes that are happening as well. We're working with our entities because we're seeing the signs of fatigue, and we want to make sure that that doesn't create additional operational risk, that we're not just seeing tick box compliance, that we're actually seeing real attempts to embrace the prudential standards. But it's going to take time. We've done a staggered approach to our data collection, so that's going to take a couple of years to come in, and there's a lot of elements of the reforms that have staggered transition periods. So it is going to take time to bed these down, and unfortunately we still don't have the final framework for everything. There are some regulations still to come, and we're still seeing some changes to the data collection. So bear with us, and we're certainly going to be working with every trustee out there to make sure that we can make this as smooth as possible. But I think we'll be taking a big sigh of relief as well when we finally put out the last document from APRA. So that's all from us.